Hey, this is Bentley Brown, and you are listening to The Dukan Show.
Yo, check it out. A whole new generation of young people today who belong nowhere.
But I prefer to be now cast.
Third culture kids, where the concept of the Dukan is the corner shop or the top shop.
We are live outside. Hey, yo, what's up, people?
What up, nation?
It's a revolution of expression.
You're tuned in to The Dukan Show. Stay tuned in.
Arab digital generation is shaping our identity, their creative expression, and their future. So please give a very warm welcome.
The Dukan.
Welcome to your tribe.
Bentley Brown in the building. It's such a marketable name, so I like going for the whole thing. Oh, it's Bentley Brown. It's not just Bentley, you know?
I appreciate that. Someone told me when I was very young that I should open a pub in that name. And at the time, I was very anti-alcohol. So I was like, you better take that back.
Oh, it was an offense.
But it works. It's marketable, you know, or like that's what Hollywood celebrities would choose to change their name to.
I really value that advice. Yeah. So that I don't change my name. I've obviously growing up in like the quote unquote Arab world and Africa and Chad specifically, I've been dealt all kinds of names.
Yes,
in
of
Arabic.
Course.
Usually anything that starts with ba.
Yeah.
Like literally anything.
Like what?
Hatta Ibrahim Bikhtisar.
Yeah, Ibrahim.
Ibrahim.
Yeah.
We've got Badri, Bakri, Binyamin, until all my friends on in the neighborhood started saying, oh, Netanyahu.
And yeah. Oh, no.
I had to change that one pretty
quickly. And it's Amharic mostly. It's like it's Ethiopian, Binyamin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So the correlation with the car company has actually screwed me over.
For most of
it didn't work in your favor.
I think for the most part, especially in America, you know, there's a few different types of people. There's definitely a subset. Let's say like the hip hop generation, which reveres that name.
Yes.
And it just takes the conversation into like money.
Yes. Well, it's like naming your daughter Hennessy. You know what I mean? Like there's a very specific world where she's valued. And you know,
and you, my friend, are
valued in hip hop culture.
You know, or naming her Candy. Like there are benefits and pros and cons that come with the name. Or it's like my old college roommate who was Nigerian. His name was Fortune. And I thought that was the coolest name.
Yeah, Fortune is a
I've
good
ever
name.
Heard. Yeah.
Fortune is a good name.
It's amazing.
Until I got to Saudi Arabia.
Right.
So I was living in Jeddah the past few years before I moved back to the US for my PhD.
Right.
And in Jeddah, I walk up to this basketball court trying to play pickup. And I meet a couple kids who are like, you know, waiting to hop on the court. So we introduce ourselves. And, you know, the guy's name is like, you know, Mustafa or something. And he's like, what's your name? And I said, Bentley, right? Yeah. Bentley or Bentley. Often in Saudi Arabia, I get the response, ah, Bentley, zay sayara.
Yeah.
Is marra faham
tarayish. Yeah.
This guy goes, ah, Bentley, ah, zay sayarati.
Oh, it's like my car. My car. And you're like, oh, okay, I'm just here to play pickup, bro.
And he was literally waiting for the game, sitting on the hood of his Bentley.
Oh, wow. Yeah, only in Saudi.
That's amazing.
Maybe Dubai.
But I'm more in Saudi. I vibe it out there.
I get it.
So what's your PhD in?
It's called Critical Media Practices.
Ah. Hmm. So are you critical about our media practices?
I have a lot of comments.
Amen. Please.
This is the platform
right.
for them.
Go ahead. Can you please tell us more about your thesis? Where are you in the process? And
for sure. So I'm a filmmaker kind of by craft. Actually, in college and in my master's, I studied more interdisciplinary things, sort of like communication, culture, international studies, and linguistics. For the PhD specifically, I'm working to situate my filmmaking. It sounds so PhD what I'm saying.
Just say it.
Go for it.
Ride with our, believe it or not, our audience is intellectual.
Yeah.
So get it. They'll get you.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to situate the films that I make in a scholarly sort of context.
Yeah.
And specifically, one thing I'm very interested on the scholarly side of things is the idea of disidentifications.
Disidentifications. Okay.
Which is, I think, largely known in the vein of queer theory. There's Jose Esteban Munoz,
yes.
who wrote a book called Disidentification. So whether or not he coined it, I'm not exactly sure. Usually in academics and in when you read something and discover something, you always find out someone else said it
yes.
20
right.
years before. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. But his argument was that for a lot of queer artists, they, you know, at one point had the sort of self-awareness or, I mean, society basically like tells you are not like the majority of people, right? You're like an outsider.
You're othered.
You're
this is your group. You're othered.
Yeah.
But then even when you're othered, you start to realize, oh shit, I'm not like everyone else in this other category too.
Right.
So he starts to look at a lot of artists who would then, in the context of their art, start to disidentify, not just from that majority, let's say hegemony society, but also from whatever group they've been lumped into.
Yeah.
And I like to apply that to nationality.
Fair.
Right.
And to culture in general. And these are like big words that I don't even know if we have a solid definition. What is culture? Like, you
exactly.
know.
I think we struggle with the definite. We navigate it as well as we can. But I think the truth is that it's forever fluid and forever changing. And as we try to identify where we fit in the grand kind of fabric of culture, we don't fit in anywhere. So exactly. We're constantly disidentifying.
Yeah. And this is the practice of that where we're constantly, I think within ourselves, we always have these internal conversations and debates with each other and then publicly debated on the show. And the show was born from that questioning, right? And you kind of go through this journey where we don't have it's never a solid answer. It changes as we develop and mature into ourselves. We feel that change. And I think the show kind of documented that for us really, really well, where we kind of got to play around with that, you know, being myself, Sudanese, that grew up here and lived abroad. Reem, half Iraqi, half Filipino, grew up in Toronto.
Yeah.
You know, and I think.
And here now.
And here
I've been
now,
here for 15 years. I think this is fair, right? It's fair to say that
and,
I've been here.
You know, and now you, an American, you were born in Chad.
I moved to Chad as a kid.
Okay.
Right.
Which is in some ways even more dramatic, right? Because I was moving at a time when my parents told me I was like 9 years old or something when they first shared the news we're moving to Chad. My dad's a doctor. My mom's an engineer. And we were going to work for a medical nonprofit, like a Christian medical nonprofit humanitarian thing. And at that time, they told me this news. I went to the bathroom and cried.
Oh,
yeah.
Little Bentley Brown crying in the bathroom, trying to hold on to his American identity.
That sounds like yesterday too.
Yeah. We just found him in the bathroom here at the
right
World
now.
Downtown crying, trying to hold on to his identity.
But I was like, at the time I was concerned with, how am I going to play high school football?
Of course.
Yeah.
Where am I going to find Cheetos?
Right.
And most importantly, air conditioning.
Where is Chad? Who is Chad? You know?
Yeah.
So arriving, I can only imagine what it was like for you to sort of land. And your parents sound like they do what God's work.
Yeah.
Good work, right? So how jarring was that breaking through that atmosphere? Because that's, you know.
Oh, so tough. There's some really interesting things. And this is part of this is the beauty of being able to write about these experiences. And, you know, a PhD isn't maybe for everyone.
Yeah.
And I'm not here to like pressure anyone into like reflecting and writing, but I would encourage you to try to write about any of your experiences. Because as you guys know on this show, everybody's experience is valid and interesting as hell. Especially this kind of, the themes and the motifs that are coming up for the people that you meet in a place like Dubai.
Right.
And so when we were first moving to Chad, I imagined that I would only learn French.
Right.
I heard that French was French and Arabic were the official languages of the country. And then there's as they say, like for Sudan.
Yeah.
And Chad, by the way, is kind of like a mini Sudan in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Shared tribes, similar dialects, that kind of thing. And also a largely Muslim North, Christian South.
Oh, copy-paste.
Copy-paste. And also, I think you guys supported the rebellion in Chad.
Yeah. There are little handshakes here and there. Like, hey, I got you, bro.
I imagined that I would learn French.
It Fair
would
enough.
Be like closer to the English that I, you know, it was my mother tongue.
Right.
Native tongue. Oh, these are all problematic terms.
They're all, I know. See, this is
even
the thing.
Then, right? That's part of the Inquisition.
When you're in an academic space, you're constantly correcting whatever terms you're using.
Yeah.
So you're always wrong.
You're always wrong.
You're always wrong, and that's okay. And we're always wrong here. Use the one that works for today, and we won't hold you to it.
I appreciate that.
Yeah.
When I got to N'Djamena, capital of Chad, the first things people were teaching me were Arabic phrases.
Right.
And I quickly realized, I was a kid then, but oh God, okay. Arabic is the trade language. It's the common language here. And so I was taught, you know, salam alaikum, kef afi. These are this is like Chadian slang. Afi, like afia. And then basically anytime my brother and I would go outside to go meet up with friends or go play basketball or something, we'd get stopped and language trained
right, because so you had to defend or say hello or navigate the city.
So adults would stop us straight up, who don't even know us. So like, Nasara, like, is the term for, historically, it's like a derogatory term for Christians, I think. Like,
yeah, it is.
In Chad, it's the Khawajat word.
Yeah.
So it's like the…
You're the foreigner, or like Muzungu and Wazungu, Swahili.
Yeah, exactly. Which we were just in Zanzibar.
Oh.
And they, I won't even repeat the term because I find it very derogatory. And, you know, speaking of, you know, and it was used to refer to me once or twice, and I had to do everything in my power to just kind of like not get into this right now.
Yeah.
You know, but I think for you, that was like, okay, we're just going to navigate this. I'm just going to take it and I'm going to run with it.
And early on, as a kid, I would argue, once friends started telling me this, oh, you're not like other Nasara we've met.
Right.
You're not like the stereotypical Nasara. Nasara and Chad would largely be the very, fairly recent post-colonial French legacy.
Right.
Mm. So people who literally, whose jobs were to bring them to Chad to sort of, you know, economically benefit in some way or serve the French government.
Yes.
Yeah, that kind exactly. of thing.
And you know, stereotypes were that French people, you know, got drunk and did this and that, whatever. And I wanted to differentiate myself from that. And when I spoke Arabic, when I started to learn Arabic, people would say, I didn't have to say it. They'd be like, oh, wow. I thought you were Nasara.
I thought you were one
of the white French.
Yes. So I thought you were one of them is what you're saying. But ultimately that statement means, oh, you can be one
There's
of mine.
There's acceptance.
Now you might be one of mine. You're not one of mine, but you might be.
You might be. And so we got encouraged to be as Chadian as possible.
Yes, to assimilate.
And in a lot of ways, you could see this very immediately with learning Arabic, but also wearing… You know, Kaptani, which is like, I forget the name of Sudan.
Jalabia?
No, not Jalabia. No.
Sideri?
It's a special fabric that you get custom made. It's got embroidery and that kind of thing. And then in Jalabia and that kind of thing as well. My mom grew up wearing what in Sudan is called Tob.
Yeah.
In Chad, people call it Lafay, similar to the Mauritanian Malhafa. We were encouraged to do this.
Wow.
As soon as possible in the like, you know, effect of assimilating to Chadian identity. So later on, and this plays into my research now, I took pride in that moment.
Of course.
But I'm now realizing, wow, like, should I take pride in anything over another thing?
Right.
It's a question I ask myself every day.
Well, I think any first generation immigrant, you know, as a first generation immigrant to Canada, you will inevitably be faced with the question of who do you pledge your allegiance to? Who is the, where, what is the nation? What is, and all of these are constructs. None of them are real. They're all constructed by, you know, but in order for us to ground our identity into something, to be able to play pickup with random people in the street, to be able to feel like this is quote unquote home, we have to reckon with that within ourselves. And I think as we look back, yes, maybe it wasn't best practices, but did we know better at the time? Did you know better at the time, Bentley Brown?
I had no idea.
Right.
I can't beat myself up for
it. No, exactly.
That's so interesting. Yeah, like you made the best choice that was available to you at the time. And it obviously comes with its own pros and cons. So you kind of try to make the best of what you got. And here you are, you know. So it did feed into it somehow. So, okay. So going back to your story. So grew up in Chad from the age of 9 till?
Oh, they got the news at 9. I moved when I was 11.
Okay, you moved when you were 11.
Oh, you had a good 2-year onboarding. Onboarding process.
Like seeing a counselor and everything. Oh. No, not till I was 11.
Oh, we weren't there yet.
No, okay.
So then all the way until university. My family still stayed in Chad. My brother and I are about 3.5 years apart. So we never overlapped in college.
Oh, okay. Mm.
And I went to the U.S. for university, okay. Atlanta. Yeah.
And is your brother older or younger than
He's
you
younger.
Are? Okay. So I'm the oldest and OT is as well. So there is this sense of like protection. Is the word protectionist a protectionist practice? Or did you just throw your brother to the Chad wolves? Were you guys a team or were you?
We had a fascinating thing. I'm an extrovert.
Right.
Yeah.
And he's a little bit more introverted.
Right.
I don't really buy these terms completely because he's got a lot of really outgoing parts of his personality. And I had definitely can appreciate my time to myself as well. But this was really crucial when we moved away from N'Djamena, the capital city, to Ati, which is a small town in the middle of Chad.
Yeah. Mm.
And suddenly you know, in N'Djamena, we had like these fallback friends. We had like some of our first friends were like, you know, half chatty and half French. So they're already going through the identity issues themselves. And other, basically other like white kids, like European, like missionary kids and that kind of thing. The U.S. Embassy would throw this like monthly party.
Right.
Right.
Where I could find my Cheetos.
Yo. Yeah, hey. There it is.
There you go. Check one box.
Exactly.
And then we go to Ati, this small town, and suddenly we are literally the only white kids for like a span of a radius of hundreds of kilometers.
Wow.
And there are, however, other Chadians and kids from Libya and Sudan who had moved to that town too. So I find that very fascinating now reflecting on that. Because when you first go somewhere and everything's new, you assume everyone in this place is like this thing. Like they're like this, this you know, model of person. I had a moment actually in Chad. I was about like 2 months into it learning Arabic. And we went with a Chadian family friends in the same car to go see a concert. And said, of course, the concert's at this like Institut Français, like, you know, French Cultural Center, whatever.
Right.
And as we're pulling into this place, the parking attendant is just not understanding my dad, right? My dad's Arabic at the time. I love to make fun of my parents' Arabic.
Yeah.
But
it wasn't best practices.
It wasn't best practices right? either. But my dad was at the time, he speaks great Arabic. But at the time he was like, and the guy was like having trouble talking back.
Right.
And then our friend Jiber, this guy, turns back to like the rest of the car to us, and he's like, yo, this guy doesn't even speak Arabic. And I had this revelation moment. Like, not all Chadians speak Arabic.
Right.
You know, and that even within Chad, even Chad's not a monolith. Even within Chad, I'm gonna encounter people who are coming from different language backgrounds and cultural backgrounds across the country. So that was an interesting thing that we encountered.
That's huge. For me, it's fascinating because, well, obviously when you went back to Atlanta, right? And what little I know, though I do try to read as much as I can, the politics of race in Atlanta is, I mean, there's a lot to be said. How was that?
Yeah.
You, because you must have this kind of common thread between… I don't know. Just explain I can't even get it out. I'm so fascinated. Take me where I need to go.
All right. So Atlanta's a black majority city.
Yes. Yes.
My roommate was black, American. From even in Chad, with our friends in Chad, we have stereotypes about like black people in America. And honestly, growing up in a like a white family before moving to Chad, I didn't have like a ton of black American friends, although we had a few. And so I didn't know what to expect going to a city like Atlanta, where internally, this is the weirdest thing to say on this podcast, but this is the space to say it.
Yeah.
But internally, when I see black people, like when I see people who look like who I've been living with, I feel comfortable.
That's what I wanted to get to. Yeah. Do you feel more comfortable?
I feel more comfortable.
Right.
The awkward thing is I have to say something, I have to verbalize it to have that comfort reciprocated.
Right.
At the time in Atlanta, it was super easy.
Okay.
And even, I'm in a university. I was at Emory University. Mm. It's just kind of its own little bubble in Decatur, Georgia. They even delineated their own city inside the city limits to like have their own zip code and everything.
Oh, wonderful. Mm-hmm. So like a proper university city, if you will, right?
And that's how the campus felt. And I loved it. I'm coming from Chad, you know, and like I was the fobbiest person you can imagine. I had like oversized t-shirts, khaki pants. Like if I was in the wind, I might fly away. Like ship, you know, Nile. And my experience fitting into that freshman dorm room with people from all over America and the world too, you know.
Right.
Was very rich. Mm. It was the early days of Facebook. There was a Facebook group started called Bentley's Tea is My Cocaine.
I wonder who started the group.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't me. Because the only thing I knew to bring people together was I fucking brought like kilos of loose leaf Chinese green tea from Chad.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know where I was going to find it again. And I went into that freshman dorm kitchen and would start boiling a shit ton of water. And have some peppermint on hand and put it all together.
There you go.
And then, of course, like a half kilo of sugar.
Yeah, of course. The right way to do it.
Right. Because you're brewing coke.
Well, which led to the cocaine reference.
Right. So
that's amazing.
I'm in love with this idea of Bentley Brown arriving at university, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air style, like a fish completely out of water. But then on the outside, I imagine everyone looked at you and probably just kind of put you in the category until you othered yourself. You had to other yourself.
What's great this time, he came prepared. When he first moved to Chad, they were worried about Cheetos.
And
now I was like, oh, I'm ready. I'm going to take my own tea with me.
Your concerns about food and survival are very interesting as well.
I love how they're intertwined. Okay, so you're the guy on campus now, I guess. The white guy in a black dominant school who grew up in Africa and trying to build these relationships.
Atlanta, black majority.
Black majority in Atlanta.
The school wasn't.
Microcosm.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
The school
okay.
was very interesting, actually.
Interesting. So the school wasn't. It was diverse enough.
To be honest, you went to Emory, yes?
Yeah.
It's quite multicultural.
Okay.
Oh,
like,
it's
so many international students.
I speak of it kind of in a romanticized way today, especially with the whole like wokeism and like especially the white woke kind of like academic liberal side of things where I'm doing a PhD in Colorado right now, right?
Okay.
But I remember, maybe I'm being too romanticized about this, but at Emory, you couldn't graduate without having like fasted Ramadan or attended like Diwali or even learned about like a lot of the white kids were from like Jewish, like New York backgrounds.
Right.
You had to be familiar with all those things.
All walks of life.
Which I thought was a beautiful thing. I even call it, I kind of joke around. I know you guys have the title Third Culture in your intro.
Yeah.
That's one of my building blocks for the dissertation. I'm looking at, is there such thing as a third culture?
Mm-hmm.
And is it even fair for me to say disidentification when society always wants you to identify?
Right.
Yeah.
But I would say this is almost like a fourth culture. Is like when you get to the space where you all realize, oh shit, we don't fit in.
Yes.
Now what do you do?
Yeah.
And that's its own process of culturization or, you know.
Yeah. And you start to define it for yourself. That's so interesting. Because we do that in this investigation somehow.
I mean, I wouldn't say we do it well.
No.
I'm saying we
tumble.
Do it.
Like at least you're.
I'm not saying we do
yeah,
it
at least,
well.
Yeah, at least Bentley Brown is in a PhD program for
right,
this, right?
Right.
We're kind of just tumbling through
this.
Going through the waves and like oh, so what does this mean? And who are we? And where
down.
Do you fit? And kind of questioning all of it, right?
Well, there's a difference between thousands of people hearing your podcast and about 11 reading my dissertation.
12, I will read your dissertation and understand it.
Yeah.
That's all I can give you
and
today.
And then I'll wait for Reem to get the synopsis on the show
I'll be
from
like,
Reem.
Listen. So this homie goes from here. Yeah, that's how it's going to go down. But look, I must admit, I wish more of us pursued that put in the deep work.
Yeah, the
deep inquisition into understanding the building blocks of our identity and our culture.
Yeah.
And I thank you for that because I think that, you know, everyone has different opinions on academia. But for me, revolutionaries came from my university. I went to York University for many years. And revolutionaries came. My professors were activists. They were in this. They fought for what they believed in. We would skip class to go, you know, to a rally. I miss that, and
right.
I feel like it's, you know, it's just good to see that it's just honored in Bentley Brown, you know,
yeah, through and through. Okay, and how does this all translate into your films? Because you've done a few by now already, right? So walk us through those.
So the first films I made were in Chad. With friends. I had a friend named Abakar, who was a playwright who would write scripts for local theater groups.
Nice.
And so we made like three films back to back to back to back. The final one of which, the third of which, dealt with a Chadian like football team captain dreaming of playing European soccer. Mm. And as his life sort of crumbles around him, he resorts to drugs that allow him to actually hallucinate and imagine he's playing for FC Barcelona.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so the film was called Le Pèlerin du Camp Nou, a reference to Camp Nou, the Barcelona stadium. It's sort of like Al Hajj, basically like the Hajj to Camp Nou.
The pilgrimage to Camp Nou. Yeah.
And of course, we simplified. This is multi-layered here. But
I love it.
Its Arabic and English title was Captain Majid.
Yeah.
Which is a play on the cartoon.
I was going to say, yeah. Okay. Because
the character's name was Majid.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Because it had a similar story, right? It was something about him. I mean, this, if anybody does not know this about Captain Majid, I apologize for ruining your childhood. But the actual story is that he breaks a leg or something, goes into surgery. He's in a coma. And the entire series is in his head. He's dreaming that he makes it as a soccer player.
Okay, so I clearly missed the prequel or the whatever story. I did not know this was.
Yeah.
I just watched Captain Majid playing soccer. So
that's the anime.
Every...
That's what the actual anime was. But right. We got the censored version because it's the Arab world.
I did not know this.
And you're young and they're trying to get you to watch cartoons.
Okay, so this entire the entire series is a conjuring of his imagination.
Yeah.
That's... Very much like your, well, how serendipitous.
Yeah, I didn't even know that, but I'm going to totally claim that.
Yeah, yeah, you should. Okay, that's
fact check it first, by the way. But like,
and how young were you guys?
We were like 18, okay. We were 16, 17 starting to make these films.
Yeah, and then I didn't even know the Captain Majid thing until, you know, adulthood quite recent. So I would assume y'all didn't even know that at the time.
I don't know. I gotta go check with that Buckar now.
Okay. Yeah. And then the next, so you were already very deep thinkers. You were already tackling
the… Buckar was. I don't know if I was. Yeah.
Well, you found someone.
Yeah, that I was like, I've watched a lot of movies. I think I can do this. Shots that resemble those in movies.
And so the next… So what was the next phase after that?
Well, that film itself went to Rotterdam.
Oh, wow. Russell.
Well done.
Ironically, in a category called… Where is Africa?
You know, can we talk about critical race theory right now? Like, don't even pretend you know where it is. Like, where is it? Wow. Where is it? Yeah. Is it in the middle of the map? Is it west of us? None. Is it east of us? Yeah.
And mostly flat earthers.
Okay, sure. So where is Africa?
Funny thing, I was on a soccer team in Chad. That was one of my, and Ati is one of my first ways to meet friends. You know, we would jog barefoot for 30 minutes to an hour before practice. Wow. And then have the practice. And it was just a great way to meet people. Buckar, the filmmaker, included. Mm. And one time before a game, and I don't know if this is the best pregame practice, but we would, I always have to watch myself using Chadian words because they may translate into other things in other Arabic dialects.
Right, right,
I have to
right.
keep myself in check here. But we had this dish called Masisi, right?
Masisi.
Where you have like rice with like, milk and stuff, and it's just like a super carby kind of thing that we would eat pre-game, right?
Wow.
It's almost kind of like roasted, almost. You know what I'm saying? This has been in the halal or whatever for like a while. Yeah. So it's got that kind of like sweet, you know, burnt taste to it or whatever. So we're eating this before a game.
like the greats.
Brave.
Like the greats.
Very brave.
And my friend, I think of all his nicknames, Khalat, the Kabul. We're a big nickname, big nickname culture. Right. You know? Anyway, he says, take from the middle of this dish. And I'm like, this is getting deep here.
Take from the middle. That's so interesting.
So like I reach my hand, I grab like rice from the middle of the dish. Right? And he says, you have just taken from the middle of the dish, in the middle of the high school in which we're sitting. I'm like, okay. Like, thanks, Sherlock. You know? And he's like, this high school is situated in the middle of Atia town. And Atia is in the middle of Chad.
Uh-huh.
I'm like, okay, right. I see where you're going now. Chad is in the middle of Africa.
Yep.
And Africa is in the middle of the world.
So if you're asking where is Africa, it's basically right in the middle of that dish. If you're wondering where it is,
where it all began.
Probably in the middle of Bentley Brown's stomach right before a game. if you're wondering, that's your Google Map pin for you.
Wow.
Yeah, no, so
that is so interesting.
I'm in love with the idea of deep thinkers, of young men tackling the world in their own poetic way, and really bringing voice to and light to places which don't necessarily get seen in mainstream, you know.
Yeah, OT and scripting a different narrative, like, because the mainstream narrative has your experience is not there. It's not being told. That stories have not seen, right?
I thought I was the minority. Bentley Brown is the minority. I just think I've been one-upped by the minority, you know.
Yeah.
You are the minority, Bentley Brown, by this location, if you will, this in brackets.
For sure. So eventually I go back to college in the United States and, you know, I had this filmmaking was kind of like a craft, kind of like a hobby, I guess, which is another thing to maybe explore in conversation at some point too, this idea of the arts versus the sciences, or like sort of like the well-paid career versus like the riskier endeavors, which isn't really, you know, you can't, there's a lot of risky business and even becoming a doctor or something too, you know. But I go back to the US and I'm not really like looking at myself as a filmmaker. It actually took kind of a while to keep on making those films and to return to that. And in the meantime, I wound up working in Sudan. Mm. So Jimmy Carter, the former U.S. president, had his Carter Center in Atlanta, which had ties to the school. So we would take classes that he like designed the syllabus for, or he would come visit, lecture for, or whatever. So I wound up interning at that Carter Center and then went to Sudan as an election observer as my, like, basically my first job out of college.
Nice. So would this be in the space of IR? Like, is this an international relations
much.
Space?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. The NGO world kind of thing. So I got the deep dive into that at the time, but I missed filmmaking.
Yeah.
And I was meeting filmmakers in Sudan.
Wow.
And the people that we were all in the same kind of boat. We were working these jobs as kind of like a contracty job thing, but we wanted to do something else. I had a friend of mine who was a poet, and he had actually left medical school in Sudan after years of going to the library, getting a medical textbook, and then sticking, you know, like a Nietzsche text or something in the middle and trying to hide it. You know,
so did he finish school? Did he finish med school?
No.
Oh, so he dropped out of med school?
He eventually left the career. Yeah,
wow.
Completely. So I'm meeting person after person like this. Another one is a filmmaker, Ali Yasser Al-Khatim in Sudan, who was just a straight up DP. Like, she was working for NGOs, but was looking to shoot films.
Yeah.
And that cultured in me a desire to go back to the sort of the creative world.
Yeah.
I go back to the US and I'm writing a script that was based on my experiences running into Sudanese people in America.
Nice. Right?
That's what became Faisal Goes West, which is about a family moving from Sudan to the US. And what happens is I go back to the US and I'm looking, always looking for Chadians to reconnect. And I've very rarely come across Chadians in the United States.
Yeah.
I've had one run-in with Chadians in the United States. And a handful, and even in Sudan, just a few, Saudi Arabia, a lot more, France, you know, a few. One time in America, I was at an IKEA and two guys passed by me and they're like, "Wallahi shiva humam da booti booti o ghali ghali." I'm like, how?
Yeah.
What brought you here? I usually run into Sudanese people. So that's why Faisal Goes West focuses on a Sudanese family.
As opposed to Chadian.
These were the people I was meeting, the friends I was making that connected me to that side of myself.
Okay. That's cool. And then that was Rami Dawood.
Rami Dawood acted as Faisal in that film. And since then, I've kind of transitioned to more personal narratives. Mm. So I've done a lot of archival video work, taking these old home videos that either friends contributed, people who would like visit our family in Chad, or like, you know, my friends who had cameras, or, you know, the local town videographer. You know, my dad threw a party for a friend who people say was miraculously healed.
Wow.
He had collapsed in his yard and was taken, rushed to the local hospital in Ati. There's no electricity.
Oh, wow.
For a while,
yes.
He's you know, operated on an open air.
Wow.
Winds up swelling and everything. And my dad's a doctor, but he feels helpless. Can't really do anything. Takes him to N'Djamena. Drives him 10 hours by dirt road to the capital city. There's really not much difference in care there. It's just a heavier painkillers or whatever.
Wow.
So my dad prays with him. He comes back the next morning. The guy's sitting up in bed. And he says, "I've been healed." You know.
Wow.
So these are kind of stories that you know I grew up seeing and observing, and would hear especially from my parents. And my dad was so enthralled by this experience that he threw a concert. He threw like a concert party with like, you know, a fanani and the whole band. My Arabic teacher, by the way, for, you know, Fusla reading and writing, was a musician.
Oh, that's amazing.
Muhammad Ali Bukhari is his name. And he was on the keyboards that night. And you know, we had a local videographer filming.
Yeah.
So I had this whole rich
that
archive
really
of video.
Great.
That's just one moment among many that I've gone on to make other films with.
And so this
wonderful. This was documented.
Yeah. This expo, a celebration of life. A personal, you know, a celebration of the miracle of life in so many ways. And a delve into a personal narrative that I just think is so unique. Like, I think that the path that life has taken you on has brought you to these places where you have many different passports. You can access many different areas that most people simply don't have access to. And so tell us about Revolution.
Yeah, Revolution from Afar
is
the most recent film that I've made while doing my PhD in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
It focuses on Sudanese American artists, musicians, poets who are grappling with being cut off from Sudan during the Sudan Revolution in 2019.
Right.
So as an academic space, I'd gotten a small grant to make a project I pitched to the university about the revolution in Sudan in spring of 2019, because I felt, oh my God, like this is the biggest event I've ever seen on the African continent. I remember growing up, even in Chad, friends would have posters of Omar al-Bashir in their living room.
Wow.
The countries are so intertwined.
Yeah.
You know, there's a main thoroughfare in N'Djamena called Avenue Nimeri, named after
another
previous
president.
Sudanese president.
Yeah.
So to see Omar al-Bashir being ousted essentially as a result of popular protests, people marching in the hundreds of thousands in Khartoum, was a very powerful moment.
Right.
And there was a lot at stake, especially when the military transitional council came in and sort of like strong-armed to control the situation. And I was just shocked that the international news wasn't covering this. I know that sounds so naive of me to say that.
It's extremely naive of you to say that. And you're in a PhD program, but let's continue.
We'll let that one slide.
let's go ahead.
So I was like, okay, I definitely want to help like shine light on this, but even not in the Khartoum perspective. One thing I had, when I was working in Sudan, I lived outside of Khartoum mostly. Mm. My job was literally to travel and to meet with like opposition political party members and to hear them complain about Mu'tamar al-Wathani, like Bashir's party, basically.
Yeah.
So I was all over 10 states in Sudan. I had a house in Damazin, had a house in Kadugli, and I was just
Bro, you've seen more of Sudan than I have.
I know.
You're more Sudani than I am.
Yeah, I would. Well.
So my third chapter of my PhD, I would refuse to answer that question.
Oh, okay. Fair enough.
So one thing I did notice is that there was always a disconnect. Even in Sudan, it's the whole thing. There's no country, no society, no town, no neighborhood is a monolith. Yeah. Even in Sudan, there's a disconnect between Khartoum and the areas outside of Khartoum.
Yeah.
And there was a campaign I noticed when I was there to block events from reaching the ears and eyes of people in Khartoum. Hmm. So Khartoum Sudanese, to me, were very different than Sudanese people outside of Khartoum.
That's right.
Also very different than Sudanese people in the diaspora. You know, the whole stereotype of like the Ozone Sudanese, you of know, course, go to the Ozone coffee shop. That was my place, first place that I went when I went to Khartoum. And so I wanted to share something from outside of Khartoum. Now, when I realized I couldn't travel, I was to go there. Like I was trying to apply for a visa as I always do, you know, and it just didn't seem like it was going to happen, especially me showing up like a bag of cameras and
microphones. Right, right. And the last person they're
going to have a field day.
Right.
I was like, okay, if I feel anguish for not being able to go back to Sudan during this moment, what are my Sudanese American friends feeling not being able to go back? So I talked to people, reconnect with Rami Dawood, who was the lead in Faisal Goes West, to other friends, Amir al-Khalifa, Odyssey, rapper in New York, Sinkane. And I'm like, what are you guys going through right now? And the diversity of responses was so beautiful. So I started recording these conversations. Khalid Al-Beh is a political cartoonist, the artist, the Khalid Al-Beh. Do I need to say a title? Was organizing a book launch in New York at the time that was bringing together all the
musicians. And he shot his own little documentary about his trip while he was there. I remember that.
And so we reconnected there. And then we happened to have this group called SAPA, Sudanese American Public Affairs Association.
That's very cool.
Sounds like a grant.
It feels like it's in Virginia to me.
Yeah.
Virginia?
That's what it feels like. Oh my God. The whole like Jalia system.
Yeah.
Of course, your Sapa gets like Arabicized all the time. Of course. And we wind up having a conference in Colorado, which is where I was doing my PhD. So it all worked.
It all kind of came together. So, Bentley Brown, how do you check your white privilege?
Thought you were going to ask about the Sudanese friends.
Yeah, well, no, eventually. I'm going to get to OT in a minute because obviously that's the extension. But for me, I'm curious as, you know, as we navigate, you navigate the world looking a certain way. If I met you in Dubai Mall, I would not know the depth and wealth that the fabric you're made of is. So how do you navigate that in the States or in, you know?
Well, the United States, I think, is different than other places right now in the terms of this dialogue.
Yeah.
I view America as being very American-centric. Mm-hmm. I would almost argue that a lot of the, let's say, like liberal ideas and people who are now giving their voice towards rights movements are still doing so from a sort of ethno-nationalist kind of like America's the best place mentality. There's not much incorporated in terms of other ways of thinking. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult for me to even talk about the term white privilege in America versus in Chad versus in Saudi Arabia versus in Dubai today versus it's so complicated that I do struggle to answer that.
Fair.
So as a kid, you can imagine, like I knew I was looked different.
Or they let you know. If you didn't know, they let you know.
Yeah. And kids are assholes.
There are until the day I die, sadly and good in a good way, but there are certain like kind of kingly privileges that I will have as a white person that people will often go out of their way to try to help me find the place I'm going to go. Or they're going to serve me, host me in a way that's more frivolous than someone who looks a different way. For me, and identity-wise, that puts me in a box sometimes. And obviously, like, I don't maybe want that special treatment.
Of course.
But that's one sort of outgrowth of the privilege. The other one is deeper, and it's about, you know, my friends that I grew up with didn't have the opportunity that I had to go to the United States for college. And I knew this as a kid, and I knew that the time would come, I would turn 18 and I would move to the United States for university. And to this day, no friend in that group of friends has made that journey to that sort of like level of education, with very few exceptions. And they're, you know, more locally situated, right? So people that went to Algeria, yeah, or they went to maybe to France, that kind of thing. Mm. That itself is a privilege, but it's also kind of an opportunity, yes, for me. And I want to get my story out, but I also want to get the stories out of those people that weren't able to do it.
And wonderful. You feel that sense of responsibility?
All the time. Yeah.
I think he's basically built his life on that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you can imagine how it gets tough when I'm in a room of mostly white academics,
yes,
and they ask the question that you asked. When, yes, I see you ask that question, and even, you know, just profiling you.
Well, yeah,
stuff,
like if I'm you, like, if you're just tuning in, I'm a woman. I'm a Iraqi Filipino woman of color. Always, yeah, have been, always will be.
Yeah. So like, I'm not going to, if you ask me that question, I'm like, oh, wow, fantastic question. Let's, right, dive into that. If a white academic asks me that question, I'm like, fuck you, man. Like,
yeah,
yeah,
who the fuck are you to say that? And I've had very disrespectful in interactions with academics where I'll share something very personal to me and they'll see like a trailer of a film and I'll talk about why this is important. And I'll say migration and moving across countries. And these people were stripped of their home. And then I did this and I came over. And someone will be like, what gives you the right to make a film in Arabic?
Yeah. But so this is the, these are the rooms I will not be able to access. So I'm, how do you respond to that? What gives you the right, Bentley? do you just give her a good
Well played.
Well played, Bentley Brown.
No, the thing is when I do respond, and if I can be patient, which is a very big struggle, my number one philosophy with this, and I'm the first person to learn this thing, is to try to learn this, is grace.
Yes.
So for all the struggle for equality, for all the like excruciating difficulties and prejudice and racism and hierarchies and wealth and lack of wealth that we go through, we're trying to navigate and fix the problem all the time. I think if we can opt to grace first,
yes,
that's the best thing. Now, I'm a bad example of that. So my heart rate's going up. They say something, they ask me a question, what gives you to make this, the right to make this film? Where do you get the agency? Whose stories do we get to tell? Blah, 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 blah. If I can be patient and say, well, I grew up in Chad, I speak Arabic. In one case, actually, I had a short film that was a photo album I had discovered while jogging in Jeddah.
Oh, wow.
It was like in the dirt. There are ants over it and everything. So me being who I am,
of course,
I'm like, ooh, see what's going on here. I open this photo album and the whole album is full of pictures from a reel of film, like an actual photo.
Yeah, yeah, like a film, like, yeah, camera.
It's,
yeah,
been a long time.
It's been developed. The films, the pictures have been developed.
Mm-hmm. Of a house, oh, completely empty, with no humans in it, oh, but lived in.
Oh, how interesting.
Mm.
At the time, Saudi Arabia was going through a big Saudization,
yeah,
movement in which a lot of people of non-Saudi nationality, and that could include people who were born there, right? A lot of Sudanese people, a lot of Yemenis, a lot of you know, Filipinos. Like, everybody's born in Saudi Arabia, but they don't have nationality because of racism.
Racism.
Don't come after me. Don't,
yeah, no, no. This is the one show where you can say it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's racist.
I am very fascinated by this album.
Yes.
And I'm asking questions like, who was living here?
Mm-hmm.
There's a little basketball goal attached to the dresser. Who, wow, shot basketball?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who shot on that hoop? Why did they leave? Or is this just like a really old school way of selling a house or something to show the room? I don't know. So literally those were the questions I had in this like little short film thing. And I got asked by the one person not in the class who was visiting to like critique whatever.
Oh, okay.
I got asked, you know, what gives you the agency to make this film, to ask these questions? So I had to like, deep breath.
You're like, this person is here to critique.
Yeah. This is a film,
yes,
about, I'm asking questions about people maybe being forced to leave their house.
Yeah.
It's a album I found on the road while jogging. And I was in Saudi Arabia. And at the time, actually, I had to leave Saudi Arabia. I speak Arabic. You know, mm-hmm, I feel very much at home in Jeddah, the place that, that's all I got.
Yeah.
And that person came up and apologized to me
of
after
course.
The Q&A and said, as a trans woman, I shouldn't have assumed all these things about you.
Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like we're all guilty of it.
We're all human.
Yeah.
We're all human. And I think grace, if there's any great place to kind of, you know, kind of close out the episode, a reminder that grace will save us. Because in those moments where we could have been, where we can exercise, we could get further and run further together when we have grace towards each other and grace towards ourselves.
And I could, if I could close myself with a quote from the film Revolution from a Farm, where Sing Kane, who's a musician, Sudanese American musician, the whole film people are debating, what does it mean to be Sudanese? Can I be 100% Sudanese, as this is what they're discussing, and be 100% American at the same time?
Mm.
And there's this obvious agreement. Everyone says, I definitely feel too American to be Sudanese and too Sudanese to be American.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also here at this turning point in Sudan's history saying, do we have a right to go back to Sudan?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you could, on the surface, someone like me, I might see their situation and say, damn, you've been in Kansas for the last 20 years. I don't know if you should be going to Sudan to have a stake in the country's future. Then I'm like, wait a second. Maybe your parents left Sudan for that very reason.
Yes.
Because they couldn't say what they wanted to about Sudan. They didn't have the stake in the country's future. And now there's an opportunity to do that. And Sing Kane says something to the extent of, we have an opportunity now to define what it means to be Sudanese. He says it doesn't matter how you look. It doesn't matter what color you are. It doesn't matter what language you speak. It doesn't matter your religion. It doesn't matter any other part of your identity. If you are Sudanese, you're Sudanese. I think that's where being able to accept people's identities and who they are, who they define themselves as, who they are, is a very deep form of respect.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
This has been wonderful. And I hope that this episode gives people a moment of reflection and deep inquisition, the way I'm sure it's leaving us after the session. So yeah, I hope the listeners really like take the time and enjoy this. And if you have anything to share, and let's have this conversation. I feel like it needs to be had also outside of the podcast. So let's talk about this more frequently. Where can people find you?
I'm on social media at Wald Brown.
Yeah.
Waldbrown.
Yeah. Translation for the non-Arabic speakers. That's the son of Brown.
Yep.
Yeah.
Right.
And YouTube as well.
Thank you for kicking it with us today. I hope you enjoyed listening to this week's episode as much as we enjoyed creating it for you. Please subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcast at to stay up to date with all our conversations. Also, if you don't mind, hit us with the 5-star rating, leave a comment, let us know how you feel about the show. That way, it could also help others find the show. And be sure to share it with your friends and family, whoever you think can benefit from it. You can holler at us on all social media platforms at The Can Show. We'd love to hear from you. Or you could drop us an email to hello@thecanmedia.com. Salam.